I will call the meeting to order. This is a joint meeting of the K-12 Education Finance Committee and the Tax Committee. So we have to my left, of course, Chair Ann Lincheski. And while we did not invite or make this a joint meeting of the Pension Commission, we do have the Honorable Representative Mary Murphy, who chairs the Pension Commission here, so that we can all talk about OPEBs. And I have to tell you that when this topic first came up, I had never heard of OPEBs. And I'm willing to bet that a lot of us up here have not. So we're kind of using this as a test case, because I think this will be a precursor to more communication to come of how the Education Finance Committee and the Tax Committee can work more closely together on overlapping issues. We're lucky enough to have 5 members of K-12 Finance that are on the Tax Committee this year, so that should help. We did have a joint hearing last year with Representative Paul Marquardt's Property Tax Division of Chair Lincheski's Tax Committee, and that worked out really well because then we had some common understanding, and we had the Tax Committee carried levies and things for education that ended up being jointly shared later on. But with this issue right here, it kind of snuck by us because it seemed to be a smaller issue to the Tax Committee, certainly, and to the K-12 Committee, who didn't pay any attention to it. So we're kind of going back and doing what Chair Lincheski and I and Chair Murphy wish we had done last year, which is to have a committee with all the people that understand this better than we do, and our common staff, and so we can just learn about it. And so we have, as you can see by the agenda, our State Auditor, Rebecca Otto, and then we have Jody Hauer from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Jody headed up the January 2007 report on post-employment benefits for public employees, which included OPEB. And then we'll hear from the Department of Education. We hope, by the way, to get to that point around 3:20. So we're going to hear from Auditor Otto and Ms. Hauer, and then we'll have questions on that section until about 3:20. And then we'll hear from Audrey Bomstead from the Department of Education, who covers this issue, and go until about 3:30, 3:35. And then we have 2 school districts, Bloomington, who chose not to avail themselves of this this issue, and Alexandria, who did. And they can tell us why and why not. And after that, we can have questions for them. And then we adjourn, of course, at 4:15. Chair Lincheski, do you have anything to add? Chair Murphy? Okay. Well, with that, then, if we could have Rebecca Otto, State Auditor, come forward, and maybe Jody Hauer at the same time, or unless you have 2 people. Okay, we'll start out with the auditor. Welcome, and of course, you need to identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Rebecca Otto, the Minnesota State Auditor, and I'm very happy to be here today. And the Office of State Auditor oversees local governments around the state of Minnesota, and so our office also, we issued a report on OPEB as well. But both reports were before there was actual really hard data. What we're going to do today is try to provide you with the very basics of what OPEB is and what GASB 45 is, so you get an understanding of what all this means. And it's accounting type stuff, but it's really important. And then hopefully we can answer any questions for you. There's a PowerPoint that you have a hard copy of from our office, and I also have it on the screen for you. What is OPEB? I think it's an overly complicated term, which means other post-employment benefits consist mainly of health care benefits promised to public employees upon their retirement. It can also include life insurance and things like that. The other means other than pensions, because a lot of people refer to pensions as a post-retirement benefit. Minnesota Statute 471.61 allows for local governments to provide these benefits. So what is GASB? Auditors care a lot about GASB, but GASB is the Government Accounting Standards Board, and they set the accounting standards for public entities, for state and local governments. So what is DASB 45? All this is going to build on each other, so people, you know, so we have other post-employment benefits, retiree health care, and then we have DASB, which is a board that sets the standards for auditing in local and state government. So DASB 45, the DASB decided that the financial statements of a public entity must disclose their OPEB liability. DASB statement number 45 sets forth the method of OPEB actuarial calculation of the liability and defines the conditions under which the public employer, if it chooses, can represent in its financial statements that it has satisfied all or part of its OPEB liability. They don't have to. Prior to the issuance of statement number 45, most public entities handled their OPEB liability on a pay-as-you-go basis, not setting aside any funds to pay future OPEB liability. So what is an OPEB liability? Under the DASB formula, an actuary calculates what should be put aside each year on behalf of an employee while the employee is working in order to fund their future liability. The liability for the benefit accrues during the time the employee provides services to the public entity, and then the benefit becomes due and payable after the employee leaves employment. As with pension calculations, the actuary takes into account the investment return on any money put into an irrevocable trust to fund the OPEB liability. I haven't told you what an irrevocable trust is yet, but I will in a moment. Unlike pension calculations, which are based on a benefit formula, OPEB calculations are based on less precise estimates of future medical costs. And as you all know, medical costs can change over time, and they've been increasing quite a bit. So under the DASB rules, many school districts and other public entities have needed to hire an actuary to calculate their OPEB liability. So back when our study was done on OPEB liability, those were estimates. There were very few actuarial studies done. At this point, there should be many, many more actuarial studies done, but we do not have those numbers, but they are obtainable. Entities can amortize their OPEB liability over a time period of up to 30 years. Funding of OPEB liability. There is no requirement in state law or in DASB that OPEB liability be funded. DASB only requires that the liability be disclosed in the financial statements. So really what I believe this is a transparency piece that governments have to show what their liability is. I think that's really the point of DASB 45. Funding OPEB liability. The 2008 legislature authorized the creation of both irrevocable and revocable trusts to fund OPEB. So under state law, revocable trusts are dedicated to paying OPEB benefits, but if certain conditions occur, causing the trust to be overfunded, excess amounts may be withdrawn from the trust. These conditions include the creation of a national health program, which may or may not happen. Under DASB, only funds placed in an irrevocable trust, not revocable, but irrevocable, can be counted as funding OPEB liabilities. An irrevocable trust means those funds can only be used for your OPEB liabilities, so it does lock them up. The benefits of a revocable trust, some entities wanted to invest in a revocable trust because they can utilize the same investment list as the public pension plans. And these investment vehicles can potentially grow their funds at a faster rate. So that is one of the benefits for them. OPEB bonds. So the 2008 legislature also authorized the issuance of OPEB bonds by school districts and other local governments to fund OPEB liability. These bonds were made exempt. This is an important point to make because I heard someone thought something differently. These bonds were made exempt from the net debt caps and from election requirements. So the districts can issue bonds, and it is not subject to net debt caps, and they don't have to go up for a levy either. There is also something I wanted to bring to your attention around OPEB bonds, and we can give you further information if you're interested, just in terms of timeliness, but there was a situation in Wisconsin schools where some districts got together and issued some bonds for OPEB, and we've got an article called A Cautionary Tale for Cities and Counties, and we tried to do it for schools, but they haven't published it for us. But anyway, where they got into a situation where they got a little fancy with their bonding and have gotten into big trouble over it. It was a deal that sounded too good to be true. And they were trying to make some money on their bonds and in a creative way. And now they not only have their OPEB liability to deal with, but they also have to make their bonds good. And it's a lot of money. So it's been a very bad situation. So we've tried to warn entities in Minnesota to avoid that situation. we've heard there are sales pitches going on around the same type of scheme. So we tell the entities, and it sounds too good to be true, probably is. So we're hoping Minnesota entities will avoid that problem. The extent of OPEB liability, reports on statewide OPEB liability were prepared by the Office of the State Auditor in October of 2006 and then by the Legislative Auditor in January of 2007. Few public entities had an actuary study completed. The Office of the State Auditor estimated statewide OPEB liability at $3.37 billion, and the Legislative Auditor concluded that statewide liability could reach $3.3 billion. They're all large numbers. And neither of these reports included something called implicit rate subsidy, which I haven't even told you about, and then the OLA is going to teach you that one today. So, but there's another piece to this whole thing that is not in those numbers. I thought this map might be helpful for you as a visual. This is for fiscal year 05. This is the estimated numbers, not actuarial. And this was their OPEB liability as a percent of total revenues for school districts. So it's not necessarily the best measurement, but it gives you a sense of their total revenues for fiscal year 05 with their total liability. And the kind of brownish, reddish color, those are where their liability as a percent of total revenues is over 100%, which is not necessarily a good indicator. And you notice that it's up north where it's concentrated. There are some spots in central, and then there's one down southeastern. Then the kind of robin's egg blue is the next one, 50 to 100%. And again, it's somewhat north, north central, so where the concentration of fairly large liabilities are. This is another chart from our report, distribution of liability fiscal year 05, never estimated. So these are top 20 OPEB liabilities for fiscal year 05. Now, I know today you're focusing on school districts, but if you look at the total statewide OPEB liability and then you look at the different entities, Ramsey County had the highest of the total amount. Then City of Duluth, but if you start working your way down, you've got St. Paul, you've got Grand Rapids, Greenway, Minneapolis, Virginia, Duluth, Chisholm, Mesabi East, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Erie, and Hibbing. I'm going to show you one more, so that's top 20. I'm sorry, Iron Rangers. I know some of them are giving me really nasty looks. I apologize. I'm just the numbers. And remember, these are estimates again. This chart is top 20 OPEB liabilities as a percent of total current revenues, and then it's ranked. Now, if you notice, we've got Greenway, Chisholm, Erie, Mesabi East, Virginia, Pine Island, Grand Rapids, Hibbing, and then a little further down, Ricori. So some of the school districts have some fairly large liabilities, which I know that you're interested in, and I guess I would, at this point, that's the end of my presentation, and we would stand for questions if you have any.
Question for State Auditor Otto.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. Are you going to stay in case more questions come up as we go on? Thank you very, very much. Ms. Howard, if you could please identify yourself for the tape.
Economic recovery.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jody Howard. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm going to give you a few more details to supplement what State Auditor Rebecca Otto has already given you. I do need to caution you, though, that the information I'll be giving you today is based on this report that we released 2 years ago. The work was done in the summer and fall of 2006. So all of the numbers that I present to you today are going to be outdated. I don't have anything new since that time to report. Having said that, you've already heard about the SB 45, so I'm not going to go into the details there. For the other post-employment benefits, the key one in Minnesota is the retiree health care. Other benefits can be a part of OPEB, life insurance or long-term care benefits, but in Minnesota, 99% of the spending on OPEB is for retiree health care. So health care is really the thing that's driving the costs here. You learned that about 1 in 5 of the local jurisdictions around the state, that's school districts, cities, and counties, and most of the large townships, do have some kind of spending. They do, on OPEB, they do offer retiree health care benefits. Most of those are school districts. And this slide shows that in a graphic fashion, you can see that 70% of the school districts have retiree health care as a benefit. You also see that school districts and counties are the ones that are far more likely than cities or special districts to offer other post-employment benefits. Now, we found that most jurisdictions around the state offer what we call a basic set of benefits for retiree health care as opposed to an extensive set of benefits. And I want to describe that to you so you can understand what I mean. The basic benefits are those that are offered to some employees, but not all. So, for instance, in a school district, the benefit might be offered to the faculty, the teaching faculty, but not to, like, bus drivers. The basic benefits are those that are offered only to employees, that would include the employee's dependents, the spouse. Basic benefits are also available for a limited time, as opposed to being available for the full lifetime of the retiree. In the basic benefits, the employer pays some amount, but a limited amount of the premium instead of all of the premium. The employer's contribution is capped in the basic set of benefits, so that as the premiums go up over time, and we all know they will, the employer's liability doesn't go along with it. And finally, basic benefits refer to employees needing to put in a certain number of years of service in the jurisdiction before they qualify for the benefits. So we found that in most jurisdictions around the state of Minnesota, employees have to have between 15 and 19 years of service. They have to work in the school district that long before they're even going to qualify. Now that's as opposed to in some very few jurisdictions where a person could work for 3 years and at that point qualify for this retiree health care benefit. Now, there are only a few cities, and State Auditor Otto already mentioned some of those that get those most extensive benefits. But among the school districts that fall into that camp, the Hidden School District was one. But even with the Hidden School District, it doesn't offer the full, what we call the full extensive set of benefits. For Hidden School District, the district will pay 92% of the premium, the health care premium for the retiree, less $50 that the retiree is expected to pay for single coverage. The retirees have to work for the district for 10 years in order to qualify for that benefit. And that particular district had not made any recent changes to the benefits that it offered to its employees. Another one, though, that fell into that camp of closer to the extensive side of benefits as opposed to basics was Mesabi East School District. It paid 90% of the premium, but percentage varied by when the employees had been hired. To qualify, employees had to work for that district for at least 15 years. And then there was, a few years back, Mesabi East made a change that changed how much the district would pay depending upon when the employee was hired. So that employees hired after 1989, the district paid somewhat less of the premium for their retiree health care. And then the third example I'm going to bring up is the St. Paul School District. It was also in the top 10 of what you call extensive benefits. In St. Paul, it paid 100% of the coverage for those who retired before 1986. But it made several changes, and 1996. It made several changes, and now it'll pay the amount of premium only at the time that the employee retires. So as the premium increases over time, the district liability remains at the amount that it paid when the employee retired. The district also pays only up to age 65 for those employees that were retired after 1996. For employees hired before 96 but retiring after 1998, the coverage after age 65 is limited to a certain amount. In this case, it happens to be $300 per month for the premium. So there are some limitations that these districts have put on their liabilities. So what is the amount of the liability that jurisdictions are liable for? Again, Rebecca Otto talked about this, so I'm only going to go over this in a cursory way. I do need to point out that we had
someone has a cell phone on, members, if you could turn it off. And then if it's vibrating, then we get that noise.
Take away all the fun, man.
Representative Rochevina, we might know.
No, it wasn't me.
Oh, it wasn't.
You said you're taking away all the fun.
Sounds like it's over there. So. And anybody in the audience, not just the legislators. So if you have your phone on, if you could please turn it off. We won't look and see who's doing it. Ms. Howarth.
Madam Chair, thank you. So when we conducted our evaluation, again, this is about 2.5 years ago now, only about 24 jurisdictions around the state had actuarial evaluations, so we used them as the base for our calculations. But just for those 2,000 alone, in 2006, we knew that the accrued actuarial liability amounted to $1.5 billion over the upcoming 30 years. So that was for 2,000 cities, counties, and school districts, again, mostly school districts and counties, with a liability of $1.5 billion. Now, we then went from that amount and made some estimates, and you've already heard we've estimated at $3.3 billion statewide. I feel very pleased about giving that amount just because I know that to have a reliable estimate, we really need to have those actuarial studies, and they just weren't available at the time we conducted our work. So it's a very rough estimate. Now, go back to the point I said earlier about just 1 in 5 local jurisdictions around the state offer retiree health care. Again, Rebecca Otto alluded to this, but even for those jurisdictions that do not pay for retiree health care benefits, they're going to have some liability for other post-employment benefits. And that's where you're going to ask, well, how can that be? Well, by law, school districts and cities and counties have to allow their employees at retirement to continue in the employer-sponsored health care insurance, medical and dental insurance groups. And then beyond that, when it comes time for setting premiums, statutes require that the districts and other local governments pool their retirees up to age 65 with all the active employees. So the cost, the healthcare premium, is going to be the same for the active employees as it is for those that have retired. But as we all know, as one retires, you age, you tend to consume more healthcare services. You're going to be a more costly member of that healthcare plan. And so the cost, because you're going to cost more than those younger employees, you're getting, in essence, a subsidy for the benefit you're receiving. And it's that subsidy that when retirees are, the amount of the health care benefit they're getting that exceeds that premium amounts to this implicit rate subsidy that the GASB 45 standards require to be disclosed. So that's why even if a district isn't paying for retiree health care, this implicit rate subsidy will affect them. Now, we did make some estimates about the liability for the implicit rate subsidy. There were, at the time we did this, actuarial studies from 9 school districts. So this was 9 out of the 300 and whatever, 20-some school districts around the state. But for that group of 9, the liability for the implicit rate subsidy totaled $132 million, and that ranged from about $317 per student up to over $3,700 per student, and the average was at $1,300 per student. Now, we used those figures and made some assumptions that those 9 school districts were typical. Again, remember, that assumption, I just hesitate even saying it because I know that that assumption can be quite faulty, but assuming that they are typical, we estimated that statewide the liability for school districts only, for the implicit rate subsidy only, could be $1.1 billion over upcoming 30 years. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, I feel a little bit more comfortable saying because they're grounded in actual numbers. We looked at what local governments paid for their retiree health care back in fiscal year 2005. Because at that time, and I think it's probably true at least largely today, most local governments and school districts are paying for those retiree health care benefits just on an annual basis. So as their employees retire, they're going to pay for that benefit. Well, we estimated that back in fiscal year 2005, about $110 million was paid around the state for other post-employment benefits that year. We wanted to compare jurisdictions, so we looked at the proportion that spending was of their total operating expenses for fiscal year 2005, and we saw that for most jurisdictions around the state, their OPEB spending as a percent of their total operating spending was going to be less than 1%. But there was a number of jurisdictions, including school districts, where that exceeded that rate. And the high spending was concentrated in a small number of jurisdictions. We found that the top 20 jurisdictions that had high rates of OPEB spending as a percentage of their operations spending included 7 school districts, and they're noted here on this particular slide. And of those 7, 6, the top 6 listed here, spent more than 5% of their total operating expenditures on retiree health care back in 2005. That's just the retiree health care, remember. And the last thing I'm going to talk about today is some of the steps that have been taken to control the growth and the liability for the retiree health care. And we found that across all jurisdictions, again, not just school districts, but cities and counties as well, about 54% of them had taken some steps to either reduce or eliminate their liability for the retiree health care. Some of the steps that they took will control their liability in a quicker fashion than others. And the table that is now on the slide shows some of the steps that they took. The percentage that you see listed here represents the percentage of local jurisdictions back in 2006 who had already taken that step. So, for instance, the first row shows that 29% of local jurisdictions had eliminated the retiree health care benefit for all new hires as of a certain date. For anybody coming in after, whatever, 2005 or whatever date they had set, would no longer receive that retiree health care. The thing I want to point out before I conclude is that the size of the impact is going to change based on two things largely. One is whether it applies to all employees or a subgroup of employees, and that's fairly self-evident. The second is that training is also going to matter in terms of the size of the impact. Those that discontinue or reduce the paying the amount for retiree health care for employees that are retiring after a certain date are going to see a more immediate reduction of their liability than will all those jurisdictions who discontinue the benefit for new hires. It's the point of retirement versus the point of hire. And again, it's fairly self-evident once you think about it, because once the new hires are on board, it's going to take them a few years to reach the point of retirement. So the impact will obviously be larger when the change is made for those that are retiring. Of course, the side to that is that changes for benefits that are already for employees that are already on the job, they're far less common than changes to benefits for those that are new hires. In most jurisdictions, the changes, any change along these lines will have to be negotiated as a part of, or with the employee bargaining unit as part of their contract negotiations. So making a change for those who are about to retire or will be retiring within a matter of years is not an easy thing. It has to be negotiated in most jurisdictions. With that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks. Be glad to answer questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Not seeing any hands yet, so I'll ask a question. I noticed you did not have your recommendations. This is the facts that you found, and usually the legislative auditor reports include recommendations. Did this legislation that passed square with what you recommended, or didn't you make any recommendations?
Madam Chair, yes, we did make recommendations. I didn't cover them today because that wasn't part of what we had discussed in preparation for today's session, but yes, indeed we did. And what we did recommend was largely covered by legislation passed in 2007 and 2008. When Rebecca Otto referred to the legislation passed last year that allowed local government units to establish irrevocable or revocable trust funds as a means of funding their OPEB liability. And that was our primary, our key recommendation, was that the law was unclear at the point that this report was issued, so 2 years ago, whether or not local jurisdictions had authority to establish a trust fund, regardless of whether it was revocable or irrevocable, and we thought it was important to have that authority. So that was our key recommendation.
And SB 45 just required transparency, but you recommended one better to actually fund what was being pointed out, and that's what was passed.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, what is the impact of Medicare on all of this? I mean, do these employees become eligible for Medicare? Does that... You know, how does that fit in?
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. It really doesn't have a lot of impact on this because when a person reaches Medicare age, they're going to go on to Medicare. And so for most people in most jurisdictions, that liability goes away at that point, age 65 for most people. There are some jurisdictions where, as I mentioned earlier, for that extensive package of benefits, they were covered for life. So even if they went onto Medicare, if they had any other kind of cost that wasn't fully covered, then the retiree health care benefit in that jurisdiction would also cover their expenses. But for most people, far and away the far majority, once they hit that Medicare age, they are on Medicare and OPEB liability just doesn't exist anymore for them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what you're saying is that this very bleak picture that you've painted here in terms of what the liability is already assumes that people are going to be going on to Medicare. So,
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Rood and then Representative Mullery. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is a great presentation. I want to thank you for being here. I just also want to point out that I have a constituent in the room who did a great job a couple of years ago explaining this issue to me. But I do have a question, and I'm just curious where we stand as a state. Are other states experiencing similar situations?
Ms. Howard. Madam Chair, Representative, yes, other states are. Actually, Minnesota state employees, when we compare our state employee picture to other states, we're in very good shape. There is a very limited number of state employees who are offered that benefit. State patrol and conservation officers and a few others are, but far and away, most state employees do not get that benefit offered to them. And there are some states where, you know, large chunks of their state workforce, public employee workforce, will be covered, and so their liabilities as a state far exceed anything that we're going to see here in Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
Representative Rood.
I meant just overall, including the school districts as well.
Right. I'll call on Ms. Howard, and actually Carolyn Chesky wants to add to that, unless you want to go straight to her, Ms. Howard. Madam Chair, go ahead, because I really don't have any other data on that. To give
Carolyn Chesky, and it was her bill last year, so she may know this answer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You can either praise me or blame me. But what Representative Rood is raising, I think, is really an important question. And in everybody's packet, there's this article here. And I actually was reading the National Council of State Legislatures and took this article out and had our staff copy it. And I think really Representative Rood's question gets at the crux of this hearing is, you know, is this a good idea? How are we doing compared to other states? In the first page of the article, in the third column halfway down, we're sort of praised as, you know, Minnesota's ahead of the pack because we passed that legislation. But we're ahead of the pack because we're the only state really kind of addressing it. And is this the right way to address it? You know, I don't know. And I think, you know, the issue, as you read on the article, you have someone say, in fact, our state auditors quoted it, but you have someone say, what a great thing Minnesota's doing, and someone else say, there's a fatal flaw. And I don't think, honestly, anyone knows the answer. The federal GASB required us to begin to think through its liabilities and act. The reason the tax committee is involved with the school issue, for members of the K-12 committee who might be wondering why that might be, is because the tax bill carries the public finance bill, which allows for all the local debt and all the local bonding. So you'll always see any authority to do debt for local units of government through the tax bill. And then there's also the issue of this was above the levy caps and without an election. So Representative Greiling and Representative Murphy and I all thought, you know, it's time for everybody in the legislature to think a little holistically about that. And I know Representative Greiling has some people from the Department of Education here to talk to us. But I think as members go forward and think about this issue, House research staff, nonpartisan research in both the tax area and the education area have been meeting together. And I know they're here and they might help us think through, you know, should we keep doing this or not? You know, we tried it. I think about 350 or about 50 school districts did it. They went into debt for about $350 million, and you can see that they see it as a way to come up with the money for their problems. On the other hand, it's raising the property tax. So I think it's a kind of a complicated issue, but Minnesota's sort of leading the pack, but maybe going in the wrong direction or not. You know, we don't know, but we just thought we needed to have a better discussion because this is brand new for all states.
And thank you. And when we get to the school people, I think we can discuss this more. But for those of us on the K-12 Finance Committee, the debt limit, the fact that it's an unequalized levy, and the fact that this issue does not have to go for a referendum, but all the other important issues that we deal with do. And so that's been part of my concern about it is we cut to the chase for this, but then what about other things? So I think the working together of the staff and the legislators is the ideal thing to do, and I'm very glad we're having this hearing. Representative Mullery, and then we'll go on to the Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. One, you said that they have to include retirees on their health care. Is that just the COBRA, or do we have separate state laws on it? And the second is, do we have not, I mean, we've got kind of taken care of on our pensions. We're pretty good as far as at least we're behind, but we're getting most of them to have the normal cost on there. In essence, do we have nothing as a requirement towards paying normal cost on health care and things like that?
Ms. Howard, Madam Chair and Representative, in terms of your first question, I'm sorry, but I've forgotten what it is. Could you please repeat it?
Okay.
Representative Mallory, could you be more short so she can get remember your first part of your question?
Madam Chair, I don't know how Representative Rukavina got to be short, but I don't think it had to do with questioning.
No, it's all he's going to be when he's landed.
He'll get me back many times.
So you got 30 seconds to spit it out.
Okay.
Press on.
You said the retirees have to be given...
Yes.
Health care, is that beyond COBRA, or is there state something?
Madam Senator Power, I apologize. Yes, of course, but it's beyond the COBRA. It means that anybody, that doesn't mean that the district has to pay for that person's retiree health care, but the person, the retiree, has to have access to that coverage that the district provides, and that retiree will be pooled with the active employees in that district. So that gives to the retiree an advantage because they're going to be paying a lower premium than they otherwise would. So this does go beyond COBRA.
We're going to take one more question because I could not see Representative Broad. Representative Lanning is coming here totally up. Representative Broad.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I just had a question. How many districts or local units of government are continuing to offer? You said that there were some that pulled back on their... offerings of post-retirement benefits, but how many continue to offer? Because when I heard you say the average is $1,300 per student in terms of the cost, it seems to me that from a state standpoint, our interest is greater than just transparency. When we look at how the dollars are being put into the school districts, so they're being put into the classrooms, they're being put into the district for other uses, it seems to me our interest ought to go beyond just having people know, which I agree with, and transparency is extremely important. But did you have recommendations, or did the state auditor have recommendations to districts to not go enter into those contracts, or were there other recommendations brought forward that have more teeth?
Madam Chair, Representative, first, there, as I said, there's 1 in 5 local jurisdictions still offer the benefits, and for school districts, it was 70% of the school districts offer those benefits. We did not recommend that they avoid them in their contract negotiations. We did not have any recommendations targeted to the local jurisdictions themselves. As I mentioned at the end of my presentation, that's largely a matter of negotiation with the employee bargaining units. So our recommendations were really aimed at the state level, making sure there was authority for those that decided that it was an important part of the benefit compensation package for their employees. We wanted to make sure there was some way for them to fund that, and that led to the legislation that was passed last year.
Thank you very, very much. To both of you, State Auditor Otto, did you have a concluding comment? It looks like you do.
Well, just very quickly, Madam Chair and Representative Broad, right now they're currently allowed to offer these benefits in state statute. And so they're allowed to do it. And then how they deal with it and the liability that is, you know, as it gets larger, it's going to be difficult, which you all are very interested in and should be. I just want to share very quickly, City of Duluth, you know, they're having problems too, and their retiree medical claims for 2009 will be up over $10 million out of an $80 million general fund budget. And it was only $2.3 million in 1998, so it's growing. So realizing some of these will really grow as more retirees, more people retire and they get their health care, and so it is a policy issue, but I don't know what the recommendations were back then, but I was going to offer, I know Department of Education does have some numbers on some of the actuarial numbers, but I wanted to offer to you as a committee, if you would like us to do a survey of the school districts, we could do that for you to try to get the actual numbers and then put that together for you.
That sounds like a great offer. Representative Brudge.
Thank you, and I appreciate that as well. I hope that the State Auditor's Office will consider putting forward some policy recommendations. The financial stability of the local governments are under the purview of the office, and I think it would be helpful for your office to put forward some how do you pull back on some of these benefits? What are the things that we could use, strategies we could use? I think that would be helpful going forward if we keep financial stability.
Thank you, and we do have more questions, but we're going to go on to the Department of Education because I think we're getting into being interested in that. And members, we do have
in addition to the superintendent from Bloomington, we have the superintendent from Alexandria, and I myself drove there last fall, and so I am not going to let that person come here and not get some time, so we need to get to Alexandria as well. Ms. Bromstead, from the Department of Education, if you could come forward and introduce yourself for the tape. And for your section, we would like to take about 10 minutes, if we could, for questions and your presentation and then questions and answers, and then get the superintendents up here, and then we could question all three of you. I'd like you to stay close because we may have more questions for you when we hear from the actual example school district. So welcome, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Audrey Bromstead from the Minnesota Department of Education. I work in the program finance area. I'm somewhat embarrassed watching those wonderful presentations from the legislative and state auditor's office. What you will have in front of you are two handouts.
Ms. Bromstead, if you could speak into the mic as we're taping, but also talk louder, because legislators can't hear you, so I suspect the back of the room is really out of luck.
Oh, you may have made an error in asking me to speak louder. You have in front of you two very small handouts. One shows the OPEB bonding activity for the Pay 2009 levy, which was just certified in December. The second is just a small portion of informational material that we have put out. We do have more extensive, which you can obtain a copy of it. It's primarily accounting instructions. But to provide the full information would mean that we would have to kill several trees, quite a few trees. The department has been working on the implementation of GASB 45 for about 2.5 to 3 years. And in doing so, we gathered together an advisory committee that included school district representatives, independent auditors who will be working on the presentation within their independent audit reports, the state auditor's office, and a variety of other interested folks. Through the process, we've also consulted with financial advisors, MSBA, bond attorneys, to come up with a plan. The bonding, as it was passed in the last session, was somewhat of a surprise to the department, so we did need to work backwards and then work forward again in terms of the possible ways that school districts might be dealing with the new bonding authority and the accounting methods. Much of the information that we're working from comes from the respective auditors' offices in terms of estimates. We have not resurveyed districts for most recent data. As districts are coming in to bond, we are getting copies of their actuarial studies, and that will continue to be our plan. Given the stages of implementation, FY08 was the first year for the big guys, the medium guys, FY09, and the smaller districts in FY010. The first point in which we will have actual information from all districts will be in about January of, or February of 2011, as the independent audit reports come in that have the full and complete reporting, and we've asked for a little summary also as districts come in. Looking at the bonding, I believe that at the end of the session, we were estimating that we would see debt service levies of about $13 million. Based on information, actually primarily anecdotal, looking at the probability of districts, we increased that to about $30 million for the November forecast. That was for the Pay 09 levy. and we carried out, probably in the range of 40 to 50 for the out years. Based on certified levy, what we experienced was that there were about $9 million of levies certified this year. There were many districts who were approved, but have not yet issued bonds, and that may have something to do with the fact that rates were relatively high this fall. They're coming down, and as school districts look at their bonding options, as you heard, they have many, many things to consider. They have their taxpayer pocketbooks. They have the market rates at the time. So given that this is a relatively new program, we are kind of uncertain as to what to expect. And as time goes on, we'll certainly have a better feel and we'll have harder data as districts begin reporting, both through their actual actuarial studies and also through their independent audit reports. The accounting for this, as we came down through this, we had quite a lot of discussion about revocable, irrevocable, and what the bonding authority was meant for. Through a lot of consultation, we came down with the fact that school districts could issue bonds that would be deposited in an irrevocable trust. So that portion, if you refer back to the auditor's presentation, goes to fund OPEB liabilities. They also may issue bonds, place them in a revocable trust. And again, you heard from the auditors some of the advantages of revocable trusts. In addition, they can issue bonds and deposit them and hold them within a reserve in the school district general fund. So we really have three ways that districts can go about looking at using bonds to fund OPEB liabilities should they choose to do so. And again, remember, they must carry them on their financial statements or on their audits, but they are not under any obligation to fund those liabilities. Right now, we have 33 districts who are approved for bonding. That is a total bonding of amount of $334 million. So less than one-third based on 2006 estimates of total school district liabilities. I'll take questions if you have questions.
Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Bomstead, are most school districts or are they bonding for the full outstanding liability, or are they mostly selling bonds to cover what they anticipate over the next few years in terms of retirees and making sure that they can handle the cash flow issues? Ms. Bomstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that will vary across districts. Some districts have already set aside funds in one way or another in a revocable trust or in a reserve or a designation. So it's going to vary, and a lot of that is going to be looking at their total liability, what they can afford to fund. And, of course, school districts are generally looking at their taxpayers' pocketbooks in terms of what they can bear and what other kinds of debt issuance might be necessary. So I think it is going to be across the board.
Any other questions? Hey, Ms. Bomstead, if you could stick close and maybe just sit towards the front, and if we could call up the two superintendents.
Thank you.
Thank you. Les Fujitaki, if I'm pronouncing it right.
Yes.
Okay. Chair Lencheski says I did it right at least once. The superintendent of Bloomington, and then Tom Wazorik. Is that right, too?
That's correct.
From Alexandria Public Schools, who's the business manager. So welcome, and I'll let you, whichever one is going first, we don't care, can introduce themselves for the tape.
I agree with a short straw.
Okay.
My name is Tom Wazorek. I'm the business manager for Alexandria Public Schools. And we are one of the districts that did issue OPEB bonds last fall. And I'll just give you some, you have a handout that was prepared by our district. And I'll just go through some of those talking points. As a result of the legislation, we took a real hard look at what our obligations were. We had already had completed our actuarial study, and we were actually a year early for our size district. So with the legislation passed, we were ready to go because we had our actuarial study already completed. So as a result of the legislation, then we had our school board review what our post-retirement liabilities were, the opportunity would be for us to get additional funds into our general fund, which is always a struggle for schools, as you know. And we also have district goals that these funds would give us a good way to help fund them. We also, in the past 2 years since I've been with Alexandria, we've done, with the OPEB bond issues, three bond issues, and with Moody investors, one of the things they always ask with a rating call is, what are your OPEB liabilities and what are you doing about it?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So it'll help our Moody investors' credit rating by what we did. The challenges as our school board looked at this whole issue was, one, they are not subject to an election, which we had many, many discussions over 3 months regarding that issue. The other thing was they are taxable, so the interest rate is higher. And then communication with our community, because if we're going to take this on, we want to be able to communicate to them. And one of the ways we did that was we have a community advisory council that I meet with, and we actually posed it to them, do you think we should do this? And based on what we projected our cost would be, they said, why wouldn't you do it? So that's some of the feedback we got from our community. We did complete our study. We started our process in November of 2007, and we completed our actuarial study that spring. Then with the legislation passed, then we started having the monthly discussions with our board, because this is a very important issue. So we had part of our monthly meetings in August, September, and October. We also had a meeting with our local education association regarding our goals and then how this would fit into our goals. We met with our auditor to see which way we should go, irrevocable, revocable. We met with our actuary, who is also here today, and our financial advisor all in the summer, just to make sure that we were all understanding what this was going to mean for our district. Then in August, we provided, based on that information, our board decided that we were going to move ahead with the process. So we let the State Department know that we were going to have it on our levy documents, and then we started the bond sale process in September, approved it in October. Now, the interest rate that we received was pretty close to what we thought it was going to be, even though at that time bond markets were kind of going screwy because of the economy. So, but we were happy it was within a couple, 10 basis points about where we thought we would be with that bond sale. We had four bidders, so we were happy with that. We closed in, I will go back up in August, we also then set up the trust. Then we closed the bond sale in November, and we approved our final levy in December. One of the things that we looked at in our district, a average house is valued at about $150,000, and this bond issue costs about $25. So the tax impact was fairly minimal. In our district. Now, I know in some other districts where the property values were indeed somewhat lower, that might not be the case. But for us, it was about $25 is what it cost. Our liability, direct and implicit, was $7.9 million. We did bond for the whole liability. I know that was one of the questions that was asked earlier. It's anticipated that we will be able to bring $525,000 back into our general fund from the trust to cover our liabilities. So that essentially frees up those dollars in the general fund. Our goals include offering all-day, everyday kindergarten free of charge to parents. Right now, some of the parents are being charged for that. So that will be one of the things we will be offering next year. We are also doing what's called digital classrooms of the future, where we're putting more technology in classrooms for teachers to use with the students. The past 2 years, we were able to use the additional technology or capital dollars that were part of the legislation 2 years ago, but those sunset now this year. So next year, those dollars will be gone. So we will be, you know, supplementing those dollars we were to carry on the classroom of the future in our district. And then we're also looking for, we're going to be providing some support for at-risk kids that need help, like in math and science and so on. You can see we went through quite a lengthy process, even though it was a short window to get it on our levy this fall. But I think it all went very well, as well as we could anticipate.
Okay, thank you. We'll take one question, and then we'll get the other superintendent in here. Representative Dabney, if you could come to a microphone, join us at the
bathroom. It's a cast of thousands.
There's a chair
today.
Right there. Oh, here too. Right here.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll fill in. I missed whether you indicated whether it was a revocable or irrevocable trust. You did reference that there was discussion about that. I'm wondering if you would indicate which you chose and the discussions and rationale for the choice that you've eventually made.
Resurrect.
Thank you.
We did go with an irrevocable trust. At the point in time, that's what our auditor recommended, we go with the irrevocable. So that's kind of pretty much the recommendation we went along with. I'm not really sure of the pluses and minuses of each one, but his recommendation was go to irrevocable trust. Okay.
And Representative Dabney and other members, we do have a handout from the Department of Education that has all the districts that avail themselves of it and which type of trust that they picked. So, Superintendent Fujitaki, welcome, and please re-identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, Senators, Representatives, my name is Les Fujitaki. I'm Superintendent for Bloomington Public Schools. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share information with you to help with your deliberations. I'll keep my comments brief. Last year, our district, along with our financial consultants, studied and analyzed this OPEB language. And what we found in our study was that this was great policy because for two reasons. First, give school districts an opportunity to reduce its operating costs without affecting the classroom or programs. So it's a great thing. The second thing is that it gives school districts and local government authorities the opportunity to improve their reportable financial conditions. That will help with possible financing, future financing for these government entities. So although we found those are good things, our school district decided not to pursue this opportunity because Bloomington, our community, had successfully passed the school operating referendum. The tax increase associated with that successful referendum was going to take effect for Bloomington taxpayers this year of P09. So, to maintain integrity with what we told the community during the month leading up to the referendum election, we felt that we needed to keep the property tax increases at the same level we told the community. So we decided not to pursue this opportunity at that time. In fact, what we did one step further. Because of the economy, we went out, our school board certified a final levy that was lower than our proposed property tax levy by almost $1 million. So we actually reduced our levy. Now, our plan last year was to pursue this for P10. Which is what we're doing now. We've been having conversations, discussions, work studies, study sessions with our school board, and our plan is to possibly go out for a bond sale sometime within the next 3 to 4 months. However, what we're doing is our due diligence. Our goal, our target, is to
minimize the tax impact of us pursuing this opportunity. And what we hope to do is reduce some of our discretionary levies from PO 9 such that there will be no tax increase for the property taxpayers of Bloomington, so it should be level. That's our goal. We're going to hopefully come up with that plan and present it to the school board within the next month, and hopefully we can move forward from there. Thank you
very much. Questions? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've got a question for the business manager from Alexandria. I see in 09 you're looking at a debt service of about $701,000. Mm-hmm. How much are you spending already in your general fund for the OPEB prior to it?
Mr. Wissouri.
For last fiscal year, our direct subsidy, because that's what we, that you see on our financial statements, was about $350,000 this year. That's the direct subsidy.
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, I guess my question is then, why didn't you use part of that $350,000 as part of your debt service, which means instead of going $701,000, you could have just done $350,000 in new debt service?
Mr. Wissouri.
Because the way the legislature, or the way that it worked with the trust, we could draw out the direct subsidy plus the implicit subsidy, and so that's what we are doing out of the trust. So that's a conscious decision our board made, is to issue the bonds to cover the direct and implicit subsidy in our study and cover those costs. So essentially it frees up $525,000 for additional spending in the general fund.
Madam
Chair, yes. And I think this additional spending then goes into the classroom. And I don't know if that was the intent of the legislation, because I think in effect what we have when we do that, because we're already spending some money, but we're leaving that in there and just adding on, is you've got an unequalized general ed levy is basically what you have in effect. I don't know if those who really worked on this, and I don't know if that was the intent of this. I mean, I have a concern when you're looking at property taxes, and we're going, I've got nothing wrong with putting extra dollars in the classroom and trying to find any way to do that, but I don't think the intent of this law was to use these benefits and this levying authority to actually then put money back into the classroom. And I think that's what's happening, Madam Chair, and I don't know, maybe I have this totally wrong.
Representative Marquardt, that's my concern. As you know, and that's why we're part of why we're having this hearing, because we want to work more closely with the tax committee, because the tax committee is looking at taxes. But the whole thing about the K-12 Education Finance Committee is we look at levies, but we also look at, and it's what we're all about, is equity and making sure that all students, wherever they live, have a good opportunity all around the state. So, you know, that's why the more I learn about this legislation, the more I think it was needed, and it's a good thing it passed, because we don't want students in the areas where they negotiated high OPEDs to have those students be at a disadvantage. But I think now we also have to be equally vigilant about the concern that Representative Marquardt has, and that's why we need to keep track of this in both committees very well. We have two more people on the list, Representative Anzels and then Representative Anderson. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. Earlier in the hearing, Representative Liebling started on a line of questioning dealing with Medicare eligibility, and I'd like to go back to your collective bargaining agreements with your workers. Could you tell us what kind of language you have, and if in fact your health care language results in the local taxpayer providing the Medicare supplement? Or do you have language whereby the post-employment benefits for your public workers blinks off at the time of Medicare eligibility?
Are you asking both of them?
Sure.
Okay. Whoever's going first, say your name for the tape.
Tom Wissouric. Our contract call for it to end at 65, so our liability for those retiring within 65 when they become Medicare age.
Okay.
Superintendent Fujitaki.
Not Fujitaki. They have 7 collective bargaining agreements. The best would be the teachers' contract. We provide $100 for single, $152 for family coverage. That's all the district pays for retirement benefits, for health benefits for retirees. So that's the extent of our coverage. It's been that way for at least for the past 15 years.
That doesn't help.
And does that...
Does it end
that Medicare eligibility?
Okay, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Anderson got to ask the question to a degree of what I was looking for, too. But I'm just curious, are there other benefits that you provide other than health insurance? What's all included in your OPEB package, and is that still continuing? Are you still offering that package?
Mr. Wazorek.
Tom Wazorek. Our total liability is just for health benefits, and that's what we're currently offering.
And so if you were employed with your school district today, you'd still receive those benefits?
Yes. Well, there's some qualifiers that you have to work for long in order to get that benefit when you retire, but yes, those are still in all of our master agreements.
And that's what you're talking. We're still determining what we're going to include, but it's primarily going to be the health benefit.
Thank you both very much. I don't see any more questions for the moment. And so since we have 15 more minutes, Carolyn Chesky had a great idea. And before we get to it, of course, we have Representative Mallory. But so people know what's coming. We're going to invite up, and so they can prepare, Joel Michael from the Tax Committee and Tim Strom and Greg Crow, so that we can ask them and they can help us wrestle through for at least 15 minutes after we get done with Representative Mulry's question, some of these equity issues. We have tax equity, but we also want to look at equity for students. Representative Mulry, though, you do get the last question.
Madam Chair, this is just a follow-up. I never got my second question answered before. It's a yes or no, and that's do we in any way, like on pensions, we basically have taken care of making the local governments pay the normal cost. Do we have anything like that on these health benefits and stuff that are accruing? It would be for Ms. Howard.
Oh, Ms. Howard. Okay, thank you. Thank you to Superintendent Fujitaki and Mr. Wazorek. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Ms. Howard, he's going to try again with you.
Madam Chair and Representative Mulry, I apologize. To the extent that a jurisdiction has set up an irrevocable trust and they're putting the money in that trust to pay for the liability, that yes, the answer would be yes, that they're covering what will be their cost.
Madam Chair, my question is, do we as a state have anything requiring something then?
Oh, Ms. Howard. Madam Chair, Representative Mulry, I apologize again. I misunderstood. No, we do not.
That's all we wanted. Yes or no? Thank you. All right. The staff, if you could plunk yourselves up there so we can query you. And I would like to start actually with the education, our education fiscal staff, where they can hurry up. So, Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, you know, what about these equity issues? You know, we want to make sure all students have a good opportunity, even if their contracts for retiree benefits and so forth have been are taking up more space in the budget than anticipated back when health care costs were cheaper. But then now we have some of this money also being used for things like all-day kindergarten and so forth. Could you comment or help us understand that side of the equity ledger?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think many of the school's finance formulas that we have in place reflect a bit of a tension between rewarding districts for behaviors that the legislature doesn't wish that they would have engaged in versus compensating them for excessive costs that they may face as a condition, particularly of some sorts of prior agreements. So, for example, I think in general the K-12 committee would look at as a retirement cost incurred 20 years ago
under a different contract scenario as something that the current board couldn't control and as something that a school district may have some relief for. And in fact, there are a couple of other levies that that we have in statute for school district retiree benefits. One of those was another one of those was adjusted last year, and part of the discussion with that adjustment was whether or not the school districts had all essentially eliminated these kinds of contract agreements for all of their future contracts. So I think that's one way to think about these things, is does the legislation also put an end to behavior that the legislature doesn't want to see? Mm-hmm. But on in terms of the revenue side, one way to think about that is that if there was a total levy authority of $35 million per year to give out to school districts, would it make most sense to give that out on a per pupil basis? And if so, for a particular program like full-day kindergarten for all districts? Or does it make more sense to recognize that there's some group of specific costs that districts face? And if you look down the levy limit page, those 30-some levies that the school districts have access to, many of these are for specific purposes where the legislature has said that this cost that this school district incurs is different from all others, and so they should be eligible for a particular levy. And whether that's for things like swimming pools or ice arenas or certain lease arrangements, there's a whole list of those kinds of programs. So I think that gets at some of the balance that the legislature sometimes looks at when it's looking at a distributional impact of a levy.
Thank you. Mr. Monroe, do you want to tell the rest of us? Or were you just going to tell Mr. Strom?
He was on such a roll.
Mr. Crowe, do you want to...
Madam Chair, Mr. Crowe advises me I should have also added that one other issue, of course, with school district levies is the issue of ability to pay and tax rate and tax effort. And this levy is an unequalized levy, which in general the K-12 committee prefers equalized school levies that minimize any impacts of tax-based differential.
Thank you, Mr. Crowe. Questions? Representative Anderson and then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is maybe not a question for you guys. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Do we have any data that compares these packages in the public sector to what is currently happening in the private sector at all? Or is that something that we could get a hold on?
Does anyone have that? Joel Michael or anyone from the tax staff? Okay, we don't know the answer to that. Any other questions, Representative Anderson? Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr.
By the way, before we get to you, I'll say we have never stumped them before in the K-12 committee, so congratulations to you.
Badge of honor or not.
If we go off topic, we can stump them. That's something to remember.
If it is possible, though, Madam Chair, to get some information on that somehow. I don't know how they would go about doing it, but it would be helpful just to kind of know.
And I'm just wondering if Ms. Howard, is she still here? Did you go into any of that? No. Okay. All right. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crowe, Mr. Strom, the levy sheets we are given, I'll just take two districts that are near where I represent. We see that the issue amount between 192 and 196, Farmington and Rosemont, Apple Valley, Egan, the difference is roughly, the 196 amount is three times the issue amount. The levy amount is almost six times the amount. And it doesn't appear there's a difference in terms. You know, I can't imagine the interest costs are that much higher from one school district to the other. Do you know what the difference is?
Madam Chair, I don't, but often school district bonding is not done on an equal basis. There may be a reason. For example, sometimes the first interest costs are put into the payment, the first payment, sometimes they're not. So with typical school debt issues, those payments aren't necessarily level over the course of the bond. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of the two districts either forewent the initial interest payments or whether they had an uneven schedule. Often school districts with their bond schedules, when they're uneven, will work around some of their other bond payments that they have to make to keep the overall amount of debt level. But that'd be my guess without knowing. I can't imagine that it's the price that they, the interest costs on the bonds would have varied that much.
Representative Garofalo.
And Madam Chairman and Mr. Strom, since you seem to be the answer man today, you seem to be outshining Mr. Crowe, which is unusual.
But Representative Garofalo, if you would, for the tape, to note, it looks like Representative Crowe is whispering all the answers to Representative Strom. But Representative Garofalo.
So, Mr. Strom, just to be specific. The amount that may be levied for these bonds can be no more than the principal and interest payments on the bonds, or are there extra costs beyond that that can be levied?
Madam Chair, we're getting into some issues about how those payments are structured, and I'm not an expert on that by any means, but I suspect there are some times when some of that interest would be essentially treated like points on a mortgage and all put up front if the district's particular overall debt structure would allow them to do that. My guess is it's more like the other way around, and of course the terms could be for different lengths of time, and like I said, they just wouldn't have to have even payments over the course of the bonds, and some might go with an annual payment so that the full amount needed to be done this year, and others might have pushed it into a couple of payments so that they could wait for next year for essentially the second half of the interest payment on that year's payments.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't see any more hands, so why don't we invite Mr. Michael to come up and see if there's any questions on the tax side. Representative Liebling has a question for Mr. Michael when he gets up here. Hey, welcome, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not really sure if Mr. Michael's the right person, but there's something that's bothering me about this whole thing, and let me just lay it out. Maybe I'm just totally missing the boat, but or maybe I'm not. So what we have is this liability that school districts have, and some school districts now can bond, so they're borrowing money to put in a trust to cover their future liability and levying to pay that off. But now when you put money into a trust, whether it's revocable or irrevocable, you are holding it, so presumably it's being invested somewhere. So aren't you kind of, in a way, gambling with money that you're just getting up front, gambling with it, essentially? And in this market, I mean, gee, you could be losing on that investment. I don't understand why anybody would do this.
Before we get to Mr. Michael, Sherilyn just wants to get a crack in.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. I think that's exactly, in my mind, that's exactly right. This is a problem. And that's why I think while there may have been immediate relief for some with all these other problems that have been raised by Representative Grayling, Representative Marquardt, equalization issues, Representative Broad's question, it was sort of, okay, take the first crack at it, but do we want to continue this? If not this, and I think that's the point of getting us together, is what? Because what happened in the federal government, and Mr. Michael will correct me if I'm wrong, I think this law passed in 2004 and said everybody has to get all your liabilities on the books. I mean, that's the way to think about it. Like, no more Enron. You got to count everything, everybody. And then there's been this phase-in period, and it's all coming to fruition. Okay, so all the states are going to start reacting. Minnesota was kind of first out of the chute. We can see by watching 1 year with the big ones, kind of maybe some good and bad things took place. You know, was it intended to be a substitution for funding schools? No, it was to cover these benefits. But I think you're right to lay it out that way, and I think Mr. Michael can help. I guess the reason I wanted him to talk, and Representative Wheeling knows this because she's on the tax committee, you know, is to frame up for policymakers, no matter what your politics here or what committee you're on, how do we think this through? Because if this doesn't work, if we're going to, in the tax bill, kill it this year, or expand it, or change it, or equalize it, or something, we do have to think this through, because GASB 45 is going to require all the local units of government to count all their liabilities and start accounting for them. So I think you're absolutely right, Representative Wheeling, in thinking about it that way, which isn't a compliment to it, yet it remains a problem for the Minnesota legislature.
Thank you. And Mr. Michael.
I wonder where Mr. Crow was to answer that.
Mr. Crow is safe, but we can bring him back.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I had my 30 minutes or 30 seconds to prepare for this. That I was going to phrase one of the things for the legislators to think about in precisely that way, because essentially that's what's occurring here, is the government is issuing debt, borrowing money, in order to pay obligations over a period of years. And for example, the Alexandria case, they're going to be paying 6.88% interest. And so that's a winning proposition if that money can be invested at something higher than that. If they can make a return on average that equals that, it's going to be neutral.
And then essentially all you've done is sort of spread this out over a number of years. Now, I believe that the pension actuaries assume an 8.5% return over time. And, of course, that's over a long time. And what's going on here, I mean, in this case, for example, they said we're going to issue the debt to cover all of our liability pretty much at once, or all of it within this range. And, of course, you're going to say, well, on average, we may make 8.5%, but it's like the old adage about, well, if your head's in the freezer and your feet are in the oven, on average, you're at room temperature. But it could be very important when you actually issued. You can imagine the disaster, for example, had someone issued this kind of debt at the sort of in the fall of 2007 and invested in the stock and corporate bond markets. And now suddenly they would have, let's say, 25 or 30 or 40% less money in that trust, and they still have to make their levies over all the time, and they don't actually have as much money in that trust to actually pay. And so one of the key things in this is whether or not you want them to take that risk, and secondly, who's going to be doing the investing? Do you trust that this law allows them to have the State Board of Investment do that investing, or they can contract with private entities to do that investing? What's the competence of those investors? What kind of fees will they charge? And all of those kinds of issues. So there's a question about the risk level, which is what you're identifying, but then there's also this question about how that will be managed. And so those are all things that you need to think about in determining. And I guess the other thing both Tim and Mr. Crow talked about the sort of the school finance aspect of this, but then there's another issue about whether you want to continue to have units of government in Minnesota offer this benefit, because there's a risk involved with offering this benefit, and that risk is sort of the same kind of risk that the Budget Trends Commission is talking about, and that's healthcare costs are growing at a very rapid rate, and that's why these costs are growing so fast. And so these governmental units are assuming that risk of those escalating healthcare costs. Now, everybody recognizes that's unsustainable and that someone nationally is going to have to deal with this, but you're sort of putting your faith in that by making these promises. The legislature sort of stopped years ago allowing local governments to do that with regard to pensions, but it still allows it with regard to health care. And so that's probably another issue that you might want to look at.
And Representative Liebling works with trusts, I'm sure, and her legal might know. That's a good question, even without that background. I've just been wondering about this, too, because in my just one limited family example, we have a trust for our son with mental illness, and it's been doing nothing but tanking, you know, since we set it up 3 or 4 years ago. So it just, in addition to all the equity issues that we struggle with in education that probably weren't considered as much in the tax committee, I also worry if we aren't postponing the problem with yet another gimmick here. And so that's another fear. So I hope that we continue talking together. I thank Carolyn Chesky and the members of the tax committee and all of us for beginning the discussion. And I hope our staff, and I know they will, continue talking and advise us on this issue, as well as anyone in the audience who knows about these things. Meeting's adjourned.